Hello, this is Ross Friedman reading the New York Times Book Review. First book is titled We the Survivors by Tosh Awe. 326 pages, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, $27, and the review is written by Hannah Beach. A couple hundred miles from where crazy rich Asians shop, preen, and pout for selfies, crazy poor Asians struggle to survive. They dig for cockles, gut fish, and pick the blood-red fruit of the oil palm. They sweat. Some are local Malaysians, others recent immigrants from more destitute places like Bangladesh and Myanmar. Occasionally a storm, suicide, or murder extinguishes a life unremarked. This sweltering Asian netherworld, where the air-conditioned malls of Singapore seem as far away as the Arctic, is exposed in Tosh Awe's latest novel. We, the Survivors, the story is told by Ah Hawk, a Malaysian of Chinese ethnicity who has just spent 3 years in jail for killing a man. The why of the murder is not as important as how he ended up intersecting with that kind of person, a foreigner, an illegal, someone with dark skin. If poor Malaysians like Ah Hawk are often ignored in the narrative of go-go Asia with its propulsive growth rates and plantations of skyscrapers, undocumented workers fare even worse. When recognized at all, they are blamed for petty crimes or for stealing jobs from citizens. Asian scorn is no different from the American variety. Born to Chinese Malaysian parents and educated at the University of Cambridge, Ah was long-listed for the Man Booker Prize for two of his previous novels, Five Star Billionaire and The Harmony Silk Factory. His Asia is neither sentimental nor a stereotype. There are no nuble maidens named Plum Blossom. The beach is not some shimmery backdrop to a holiday, but a broad mud flat deluged by typhoons and tidal surges, submerging villagers yet again below the poverty line. All of us worked at the mercy of the elements, the storms, floods, snakes, worms that burrow into your feet. Ah Hawk says, nature is beautiful when you look at it from afar or from a car that passes through it with the windows rolled up. After a childhood in an unforgiving coastal village where the salt and sun shrivel everything, including memories, Ah Hawk makes it to the Malaysian capital, Kuala Lumpur. In KL, as the city is known, he is employed as a bottled gas delivery man, a security guard, and a waiter. Quickly, he learns the subtle restaurant chain of command in which a Chinese Malaysian like him will be given the honor of placing the food on the table rather than acting as the sullen, silent person holding the tray, who was always foreign. That is the lesson of Asia today, where there is always someone more miserable trapped on a lower rung of the social hierarchy. Swim walking, Ah Hawk says of these faceless, nameless migrants, the oxygen sucked out of their world as they were forever in motion, but never making progress. Ah Hawk comes of age in the early to mid-1990s, just as Malaysia itself is transforming. Prime Minister Mahathir Mohamad, who after 15 years out of office returned to the position last year at the age of 92, making him the world's oldest leader, was busy overseeing the construction of the Petronas Twin Towers in KL. Until 2004, those skyscrapers were the tallest in the world, a pair of exclamation points to the nation's heady economic development. The glow the buildings threw up at night meant that you could see the dust particles suspended in the air shifting constantly. All rights. Even when nothing moved, the city was changing all the time. For a time, Ah Hawk's life limbs the Malaysian dream. He becomes foreman of a fish farm. He marries. He borrows money to buy a home, the kind of single-story row house with a cement yard coveted by those eager to join the middle class. But there are signs of unease. His wife becomes embroiled in a pyramid scheme, increasingly desperate to sell vials of neckline firming potions to the next recruits. As soon as they move into their home, Ah Hawk realizes, my aspirations had changed. They had swelled without me even knowing. The house begins to disintegrate. A cholera robs the fish farm of its foreign workers. So Ah Hawk must hustle to find replacements. A childhood friend, Keong, a drug dealer turned human trafficker, returns to Ah Hawk's life. The fall is as sickening as it is ordained. The foil to Ah Hawk is Tan Soo Min, a sociologist, who interviews him for reasons that are never quite clear. The novel is framed as the story Ah Hawk dictated to her. Tan comes from another Malaysia. Young and sharp, she studied in New York and rails against the corruption back home as if she can do something about it. She's a vegetarian and she dates women. Ah is a precise stylist with a few lean images. He evokes a country on the cusp of change. A sofa still sheathed in plastic to protect it from everyday life. The rusting tin for Danish butter cookies now holding a man's life savings. The small-time crook with three rings on each hand and cash held together with a rubber band. But at times the novel feels like a morality tale in which the message is more finely honed than the characters themselves. The migrants toiling in construction sites or starving in human smuggling camps are not given full shape. Even a hawk is a mystery. Perhaps, though, that is the point. Of the man he killed, a hawk says, his face remains a blank, even though it should be the one thing I remember from that night. The laborers who built modern Malaysia, all reminds us, are destined for obscurity, each layer of cement and heavy load they carry crushing who they really are. The next book reviewed is titled Karl Marx, Philosophy and Revolution by Shlomo Avineri. 217 pages, published by Yale University Press, $26. And the review is written by James Miller. As an influence on social change, the gospel, according to Marx, has few rivals. In his economic works, Marx predicted that capitalism would inevitably collapse, and in the Communist Manifesto, he exhorted the workers of the world to unite and seize political power, then forge a stateless, classless society of perfect harmony. Neither has happened yet, but what has happened as a result in part of Marx's work is impressive enough. In the late 19th century, his teachings informed the rapid rise of what became, for a time, the largest mass political party in Europe, the Social Democratic Party of Germany. In eschewing the reformist policies of the Soviet Social Democrats, Russian Marxists led by Lenin in 1917 and Chinese Marxists led by Mao in 1949 treated Marx's writings as the authoritative basis for designing despotic new forms of rule as a means for realizing communism. More recently still, millennial socialists in the U.S., following in the footsteps of the new left of the 60s, have rejected both reformist political parties and totalitarian communist regimes in hopes of realizing a more fully democratic version of Marx's original vision of social justice. As the headline of a 2017 New York Times op-ed piece by Bhaskar Sankara, the editor of the contemporary American Marxist journal, Jacobin, put it, "Socialist's future may be its past." Meanwhile, Marx himself continues to inspire fresh research, which now includes Karl Marx, Philosophy and Revolution, by Shlomo Avineri, a political scientist who served as Director General of Israel's Foreign Ministry under Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin. Unlike Jonathan Sperber in his justly lauded Karl Marx, A 19th Century Life, published in 2013, Avineri treats Marx not as a figure of the past, but as a prophet of the present. He clearly admires the messianic strand in Marxist thought. Unlike Gareth Stedman Jones and Karl Marx, Greatness and Illusion, 2016, arguably the definitive biography for our time, Avineri chooses not to dwell on the great man's manifold illusions or his attraction to naked force, playing down key texts that defend, for example, the dictatorship of the proletariat. Besides being approachably succinct, Avineri's sympathetic account is distinguished by its appearance in the highly regarded Jewish Lives series. Both of Marx's parents were the children of rabbis, and according to the strict matrilineal principles of Jewish law, he was born a Jew, but at no point was he observant. His father, in order to keep his job as a lawyer in the Rhineland under Prussian rule, converted to Christianity. Marx's knowledge of matters Jewish was minimal, and he followed no pattern of Jewish life. Even worse, he harshly attacked Judaism in one of his first public essays and peppered his private correspondence with anti-Semitic slurs. At the same time, Marx was a staunch supporter of Jewish emancipation, and as Avineri recounts, he became an improbably close friend of Heinrich Graetz, the renowned German-Jewish author of a multi-volume history of the Jewish people. For several summers, the two old men arranged to take the waters together at Karlsbad in Bohemia. Avineri imagines them strolling through the spa and sharing their ideas about history, past, present, and possibly future, in a dramatic prefiguration of the encounter between Zion and Kremlin. It's a charming fantasy, and Avineri's humane biography capably makes the case for taking Marx seriously today as a pragmatic realist as well as a messianic visionary who never lost his belief in a redemptive future. The next book reviewed is titled The Second Mountain, The Quest for a Moral Life by David Brooks, 384 pages, Random House, $28, and the review is written by Mark Epstein. The ego, a necessary construction, can also become a burden in its unrelenting focus on power, achievement, and sensual gratification. It breeds a culture, both inner and outer, of oppression, insecurity, addiction, and loneliness. Enough is never enough. There is always someone richer, more accomplished, and more successful than you are. Spiritual traditions across the world have offered counsel. The happiness that comes from accumulation is fleeting, they remind us. There is another kind of happiness, let's call it joy, that comes from helping others. David Brooks has a feel for the serenity such a passion can bring. He dubs it the second mountain. While self-satisfaction is the first mountain's primary goal, gratitude, delight, and kindness spring from a life devoted to service. In the cherry blossom shade, a Japanese haiku reminds us there's no such thing as a stranger. Surrender of self awakens love and connection. Brooks is an unlikely avatar of interdependence. A prominent journalist and columnist at the New York Times, he is by his own description a workaholic and insecure overachiever. Part memoir and part manifesto, The Second Mountain is a chronicle of his gradual climb toward faith. In a sparkling and powerful introduction, Brooks equates the shortcomings of Western culture with his own failings as a husband. My first mountain was an insanely lucky one, he writes. I achieved far more professional success than I ever expected to. But that climb turned me into a certain sort of person, aloof, invulnerable, and uncommunicative. At last, when it came to my private life, I sidestepped the responsibilities of relationships. Brooks does not mince words here. The rampant individualism of our ego-obsessed culture is a prison, he declares, a catastrophe. First Mountain people are divided, alienated, and insufficient. They suffer from a rot in their moral and cultural foundations that is mirrored by the rot we see in our politics. Second Mountain people have been given themselves away, lead lives of deep commitment. For them, happiness is good, joy is better. Good, but joy is better. Happiness comes from accomplishments. Joy comes from offering gifts. Happiness fades. We get used to the things that used to make us happy. Joy doesn't fade. To live with joy is to live with wonder, gratitude, and hope. People who are on the second mountain have been transformed. They are deeply committed. The outpouring of love has become a steady force. This is beautiful stuff. In admitting to his failure as a husband, Brooks tantalizes with a promise to chronicle his own unsteady recovery. In this, he only partially delivers. As soon as he alludes to the problems in his marriage, he offers a disclaimer. My ex-wife and I have an agreement that we don't talk about our marriage and divorce in public, he writes. In what was initially a mea culpa, he offers the barest of apologies. I prioritize time over people, productivity, and relationship. But something severe must have happened to throw Brooks into the dark night of his soul. In 2013, his marriage of 27 years dissolved. He moved into an apartment. He missed his children, was lonely, ashamed, and adrift. To set himself right, having failed at commitment, he decided to write about people who do commitments well. He does this with a feel for those who, rather than succumbing to their own personal traumas, turn toward helping others and in so doing renew the lost sense of community that afflicts an America whose churches, neighborhoods, mores, and cultural institutions are all in decline. What follows reads unfortunately like one long commencement address. Inspirational quotes from the likes of C.S. Lewis, Alain de Botton, Viktor Frankl, David Foster Wallace, Carl Jung, E.O. Wilson, William James, and Abraham Lincoln recur while we hear about people who courageously send their children to public schools and invite their neighbors over for dinner. Brooks believes in the ground-up remaking of community rather than a top-down government-inspired reform. He faults the culture's free-willing encouragement of rampant individualism for most of society's ills and puts his blame squarely on free-to-be-you-and-me liberalism. His argument, inspiring in his introduction, quickly becomes repetitive and tendentious. He has a penchant for lists, the four commitments, the 10 personality traits of a suitable marriage partner, the 6 layers of desire for italicized Greek and Hebrew words, chesed, Hebrew for loving kindness, and for the kinds of stories politicians often cite in proclaiming what they take to be the enduring goodness of their version of real Americans. Through all of this, we wonder, what about his own journey to faith? What really happened to get him there? Will his agreement with his ex-wife stop him from showing his face? Finally, toward the end of the book, Brooks's aha moment is revealed. Hiking in Aspen in the throes of remorse over his failed marriage, he pauses to read a Puritan Prayer. It speaks to him of the redemptive power of suffering, of grace and repentance, and he senses the presence of the sacred in the realities of the everyday. Something opens in him such that he begins to notice a connection with his research assistant, a woman 23 years his junior. Anne and I had worked together for 3 years, and I valued her work tremendously, but barely noticed her as a person, Brooks assures us. I was an inept and absent colleague. But after his epiphany, things begin to quicken between them. She resists and for 3 years moves away, but Brooks persists. In the spring of 2017, they are married. While his first wife had converted to Judaism and kept their home kosher, in this marriage, Brooks hints of his own conversion to Christianity. He appears to still be wrestling with it. Do I believe in the resurrection of Jesus Christ? He asks. The simple, brutally honest answer is, it comes and goes. This is the only time that this matter of certainty expresses any doubt. His book would be immensely more powerful with more of it. Nor is there any of the self-deprecating humor we might expect from someone who has climbed the second mountain. Brooks does remember a lunch with the Dalai Lama. He didn't say anything particularly illuminating or profound, Brooks makes a point of telling us. But every once in a while, he just burst out laughing for no apparent reason. Brooks was touched by the Dalai Lama's infectious joy, but does not return the favor. Despite lots of illuminating and profound quotes and stories, he never makes us smile. In trying to crack the hard shell of his ego, Brooks yearns to wake up his heart and soul. He looks to writings as his vehicle. He buys a Fitbit to keep an eye on himself. It keeps telling him he is sleeping between 8 and 11 in the morning when he is, in fact, writing this book. He takes this as a positive message, that he is relaxed and in the flow. But maybe the Fitbit was trying to tell him something. The Lord works in mysterious ways, after all. The next book reviewed is titled Everything Inside, Stories by Eldwidge Danicat. 223 pages, published by Alfred Knopf, $25.95, and the review is written by Amanata Forna. Throughout the stories and Everything Inside, Eldwidge Danicat's birthplace, Haiti, emerges in almost mythic fashion. It is a land where life can be changed, a land that exists both in the past and the present, whose essence may be carried as far as Miami or Brooklyn. Perhaps most of all, it is a land that is rarely visible, for despite its overwhelming presence in these stories, Danicat sees only two of them there. In and from this unseen Haiti, a woman's ex-husband's new lover will be kidnapped. A woman's father will return to be part of a bright post-dictatorship future. A faithless husband will try to reconcile with his wife, only to lose her and his daughter in the earthquake of 2010. A desperate man ditched from a raft will crawl onshore and into the arms of the woman who will become his wife. The stories and Everything Inside were published over a 12-year period from 2006 to just last year. What brings them together, apart from the land and people of Haiti, which has dominated so much of this writer's career, are Danicat's precise yet emotionally charged prose and the way she has curated this slim volume, bringing its elements together to create a satisfying whole. The unreliability of the human heart connects many of these stories. In Dosis, a hardworking Miami nursing assistant, Elsie sends most of her savings to her ex-husband, Blaze, in order to pay the ransom for his girlfriend, once her best friend. The heart that betrays belongs not to Blaze or Elsie's former friend, but to Elsie herself. She couldn't care for these people who cheated on her and then abandoned her, yet she does. In the story called In the Old Days, the daughter of a dying man arrives in Haiti to meet him for the first time, having been born after he and her mother separated and divorced. But despite the momentous nature of the occasion, her heart fails to be stirred. In her flushed and distressed face, she says of her father's second wife, "I saw the void my father had left as clearly as if it were a gash, a wound, a scar. I was desperate to feel what she was feeling. I envied it, coveted it. The title of the Port-au-Prince marriage special refers to a common type of cheap fake gold ring that foreign men give to the young Haitian women they use for sex, and the plot revolves around just such a gullible young woman who contracts HIV. In addition to its exploration of superstition and desperate hope, the story might be read as a critique of the actions of some foreign aid workers who added to the country's miseries after the earthquake. But if, as these stories demonstrate, Haiti takes other stories, reveals how much it also gives. And Hot Air Balloons is the place where the daughter of a successful Haitian emigre finds her life's purpose, as well as the place her college roommate, the child of poor migrant crop pickers, is desperate to avoid. Yet it's also the bridge between these two young women. And Sunrise Sunset, an Alzheimer's sufferer, manages to help her daughter find the strength she herself acquired growing up in Haiti, despite having tried so hard to protect her U.S.-born children, that they are now capable of overcoming any kind of sadness. Although this is arguably the least successful story in the collection, it's also the most ambitious. At one point, the mother is apparently delusional at another seemingly reflecting on the same moment as if she had been coherent the whole time. But this is a minor criticism of a beautiful book which ends with a tender description of the final thoughts of a dying Haitian refugee, of the airless sensation of his body, and of his love for his wife and child. The next book is titled The Warlow Experiment by Alex Nathan, 258 pages, published by Doubleday, 2695, and the review is written by John Vernon. The warning signals in Alex Nathan's novel, The Warlow Experiment, are there from the start. Based on what is apparently a true story, the experiment of Nathan's title is the stuff of, if not a mad, then at least a very potty scientist. Herbert Powys, a gentleman botanist in 18th century England, offers £50 per annum for life to any man who will live alone for 7 years in the basement of his manor. Morham House. The man must not cut his nails or beard and will not see or speak with another human being for the duration of his confinement. Meals will arrive and trash be removed by a dumb waiter. Powys's real and fascinating thesis to test is whether a human being can survive in absolute solitude. Only one person answers Powys's advertisement, John Warlow, a local laborer. Weekly, Powys will give Warlow's wife money for the family's upkeep now that her husband can't work. Showing Warlow around the site of his future confinement, Powys proudly points out the bookshelf he's installed for his subject. "Never read a book," Warlow says. "Here's the organ," Powys offers. "Organ," is Warlow's reply. Powys instructs his subject that he must write his daily thoughts in a journal. "Journal? What is that, Mr. Powys, sir?" Warlow asks. "Mr. Powys, sir?" Warlow asks. Readers will wonder about this comic series of portents that Powys, in his enthusiasm for his experiment, ignores. Obsessed with writing up his findings for the Royal Society and achieving its members' esteem, he cheerfully declares, "Good luck, Warlow," before locking the confused man in and instructing his footman to nail some sturdy planks across the door. What could possibly go wrong? Nathan's method is to rotate points of view between her two central characters, emphasizing not their differences but their parallels. Powys is himself a recluse with solipsism, a tendency from his youth. As his experiment sours, other characters, his servants, Warlow's wife, join the rotation, and we learn that Morham House has become a hornet's nest of secrets, spying, and betrayals, especially when some of its inhabitants, inspired by the French Revolution and Tom Paine, recognize the cruelty of Powys's investigation. Warlow, meanwhile, lives in an increasingly dark and squalid environment that he can barely navigate. Feet her toenails like horn, digs at them with fingers, but he's gnawed those nails down, tries forcing a foot into his mouth, but his body is stout, stiff, can't bend. He topples off the chair. Lies on the patterned floor, bemused. Why move? For what? Until he gets cold. In a novel premised on stagnation, this incremental but inevitable deterioration of both major characters becomes an unexpectedly gripping drama, fueled by the attraction of repulsion. Powys can't resist an affair with Warlow's wife, who visits his house weekly for her money. Simultaneously, Warlow's mind gradually grinds down like a wineless mill with no corn. Annoyed by its ticking, he smashes his clock. Eventually, he destroys the furniture, books, and organ. After 4 years, Powys recognizes that his experiment has failed. Given the chance, he refuses to leave the nest he's fouled and must be dragged out by those who can stand his stench, because by now he's developed a variation of Stockholm Syndrome. Call it Morham House Syndrome. At last, the novel veers into pure gothic horror, and Nathan's writing, having lost its subtle, ironic edge, barely skirts histrionics. With its echoes of Frankenstein and Michael Myers, plus a quote from Psalm 130 and a meteor in the sky, the final scene piles it on. Surprisingly, though, such lapses fail to spoil this unique and chilling novel. And I have time for one short review here. And it's from the short list called, which is a weekly feature and has a theme. And the theme of this short list is Japanese literature. The review is written by John Williams. The title of the book is The Frolic of the Beasts by Yukio Mishima, translated by Andrew Clare. 166 pages, published by Vintage International Paper, $15. This short novel by one of the most acclaimed writers of the 20th century was originally published in Japanese. In 1961, it revolves around a love triangle so misshapen that it's essentially a horror story. It begins with a young man named Koji being released from prison. 2 years before, when he was a 21-year-old student, Koji had been hired to help a man named E.P. at a ceramic shop. E.P., the 40-year-old owner of the shop, is also a literary critic and translator. The younger man falls in love with Yippie's wife, Yuko, and begins an affair with her. One night, after Yuko and Koji walk in on Yippie and a lover, Koji ends up assaulting Yippie, bashing his head with a wrench. That's the relatively normal part. When Koji is released from jail, Yuko takes him back under her wing. She is censured for her rashness by the prison governor, who said he had never before heard of a case where a member of the victim's family had become the criminal's guarantor. She brings him back into the orbit of her husband, who now has trouble communicating because of his injuries from the attack. After 2 years of anguish, each of them had perhaps finally found happiness, Mishima writes. Yuko had E.P. exactly as she wanted him. Koji had his freedom. And as for E.P., he had something very peculiar. What exactly does E.P. have? For the villagers and for the readers, there was pleasure in guessing how their immoral behavior would turn out. The novel's plot isn't really enough to sustain even its relatively brief length, and there's a slackness to certain scenes that's missing in Mishima's other work. But two primary things make this book worthwhile. First, it may be a minor work, but Mishima is a giant, and even the minor works of giants are inherently interesting. Second, the uniquely askew relationships at the center of the story mean that its most riveting scenes are well and truly riveting, unforgettable even. There is a macabre fascination tinged with pitch-black humor in Koji's meeting E.P. again after he is released from prison. And in a shocking moment, when Yuko kisses Koji in front of her bewildered husband, there is the unveiling of a profound cruelty. This is Roz Friedman signing off for the New York Times Book Review. I will be back next week.